Highbridge, a division of Recorded Books, presents Life After Kafka by Magdalena Platsova, translated by Alex Zucker, read by Krista Lewis. New York, October 15, 1975. Dear Mr. Canetti, I read your book about Franz Kafka and my mother Felice, née Bauer. I wish I had never gotten hold of it. Unfortunately, there is always some friend who comes along and hastens to inform me of the latest achievements in Kafkaology, or is it Kafkography, which, evidently, to judge from the number of titles at least, is a highly profitable business. I will not dwell here on the personality of Franz Kafka. I have nothing more to add beyond what you yourself quite accurately described in your book. Whether he was a great writer, I honestly cannot judge. What I know beyond a doubt is that he was a neurotic, a masochist, and, in regard to his relationships with women, a sadist as well. Every one of the letters that you quote from so extensively would, in my opinion, be worthy of psychiatric evaluation, and any one of them would have been reason enough for my mother to break up with him as quickly as possible. Why she did not, I truly have no idea. I have not yet had an opportunity to explore this aspect of my mother's personality. I expect the fashion of the times may have played a role, an echo of fin de siècle decadence. My mother adored Strindberg, who, as you will admit, is also quite morbid in some respects. But even I only found out about this love of hers from Kafka's letters when I read them along with everyone else after my mother's death. My parents were from the old school and maintained a certain distance from me and my sister. We knew very little about their inner lives, but enough that I feel it necessary to object in the strongest possible terms to the way you dealt with my mother in your rash and sensationalistic book. Already the false, pseudo-scandalous revelation on the opening page betrays the superficiality of your approach. So, at long last, we know the name of the woman who until now has been hidden behind the initial F. Dear sir, if you had actually cared to find out, you could have known my mother's full name years ago, even without the use of any detective methods. You had only to read the readily available biography of Kafka, written by Max Brod, of whom I also have no great opinion, but at least one cannot deny his goodwill, and, at least as it relates to my mother, a certain sensitivity. My mother was a woman of many talents. She leaned more toward a practical orientation, a no-nonsense person, as they say in this country. Yet she was always deeply influenced by art, literature, theater, and music as well. My father, a banker by profession, was an excellent pianist, and had circumstances in his youth permitted, he would have devoted himself to music. Art was one of the charms with which Kafka impressed my mother. He was, after all, a published author, as people say nowadays. That certainly played its part. My mother did not receive a formal education. At the age of 15, she had to leave school and take on employment, by her own efforts, working her way from the lowly position of typist all the way up to head of sales. But she always took great pleasure in reading and enjoyed being enlightened. When we fled in the 30s, first from Berlin to Geneva and then to America, instead of valuables, she took books with her. She had a special collection of volumes dedicated to her by Kafka, which she kept grouped together, some 60 titles in all. There was even a copy of the Bible among them. After her death, I sold them to the Fischer Publishing House in Germany. It was the only money I made on Kafka at a time when every Tom, Dick, and Harry was making a killing on him. My mother was very emotional, a warm and generous woman. When she was still single, she cared for war orphans at the Jewish home in Berlin, and even after she was married and had a family, she maintained close relationships with them. Her girls would come to visit, and she helped them in all sorts of ways. She was enterprising, resourceful, optimistic, and cheerful. She refused to let anything break her. Anyone who knew her couldn't help but love her. She had a talent for organization and business. In the end, it was she who supported the family after our immigration to America, especially the last 12 years, after my father suffered a heart attack and could no longer work. I, too, did my best to help, of course, to whatever extent I was able, tutoring other students, getting scholarships, and so on. My mother took courses in massage and hairdressing and opened her own beauty salon. She also baked and sold cookies with her sister, eventually expanding the range of products they offered. Then she opened a yarn store, selling knitting supplies and notions, but it never, I repeat, never would have crossed my mother's mind to try to make money from Franz Kafka's letters, which she kept hidden away in secret for 40 years. I myself only came to know of their existence from a relative when I was 18. Before then, I had no idea that my mother had had a relationship with anyone named Kafka. I only knew his name from the spines on the books we had at home, which I had given a cursory glance, but they had never captured my interest. Brod's biography of Kafka, published in Prague before the war, didn't find its way into my hands until the 50s, when it was reissued in expanded form in Germany. Like everything else that had to do with Kafka, I didn't discuss it with my mother. But I do know for certain that she read Brod's biography as well as Kafka's diaries and letters to Milena. What she thought of them, I have no idea. I can only guess. You, sir, wrote that my mother had the heart to sell the letters in this way. You indirectly accuse her of being insensitive and self-serving, even mocking her. How heroic! Taking swipes from a safe distance at a woman about whom you know not one whit and who cannot defend herself. How could anyone know anything about my mother when the recipient of her letters so carefully destroyed them, whereas she preserved every postcard, every telegram, even letters that didn't belong directly to her and weren't written by Kafka, but touched on their relationship in some way, like the letters Kafka's mother Julie wrote to my grandmother Anna. I've often wondered why she saved everything so meticulously. It's true. My mother was very fastidious. Every scrap and sheet of paper had its place with her, carefully labeled and classified. It was a habit. A passion of sorts, probably one that she took home with her from the office. Reading Kafka's books, it even occurred to me that this fascination, one might call it, with modern bureaucracy was something the two of them had in common, yet each approached it from a totally different perspective. My mother from the standpoint of efficiency and reason, though every passion also exposes the irrationality within itself, and Kafka from the standpoint of madness, which did nothing to change the fact that he was a very capable clerk, as all of his contemporaries attested to. But I don't mean to dabble in your profession. You are the one who's here to interpret Kafka. I'll stick to my mother. It also occurred to me that maybe for her that bundle of letters was sort of a legal document. Whether a defense or an indictment, who knows? Probably both. But either way, it had to be complete. As I already said, she never spoke to me about Kafka and their relationship, even when I was an adult. But from the way she clung to the letters, it was obvious it wasn't a dead issue for her. That unhappy 5-year period shaped the rest of her life in a fundamental way. For most of her life, my mother enjoyed complete anonymity. Nobody took any interest in her. Nobody knew who she was. It wasn't until a few years after the war, when Kafka began to get famous and a mad dash was unleashed for every word he ever wrote, that she began to worry. And rightfully so, that some information she regarded as intimate might be made public. She had made up her mind to destroy the letters before she died, and she truly wanted to go through with it, but she couldn't work up the courage. So she kept putting it off. In the end, she did dispose of some of them, which I know not from my mother, who at the time suspected me of conspiring with Schocken, but from her best friend. She clung to Kafka's letters with an incredible stubbornness, and it wasn't easy getting her to sell them. Mr. Schocken and Max Brod spent years trying to persuade her. Ultimately, she gave in. Not for the money, although she was sick and in need of funds, but at a certain point she realized that she wouldn't be able to destroy the letters as she had planned, and if she died, she would lose control over them. I explicitly threatened to sell her letters once she passed away, and the truth of the matter is I coerced her into selling them. Her pangs of conscience at betraying Kafka, no one could ever convince her that it wasn't a betrayal, were presumably mitigated by Schocken's promise that he would donate the letters to the National Library in Jerusalem after they were published. Alas, Mr. Schocken passed away in 1959, a year before my mother, so he was unable to honor his promise. Whether or not his heirs kept his commitment, I have no idea. I would have hoped they would have let us know. I am not happy to return to all this, and would just as soon have forgotten it. But I must stand up for my mother. If not in front of your readers, then at least in front of you. No, my mother did not, as you wrote, have the heart to sell Kafka's letters. Not only that, and I say this only to you with shame and great pain, but I believe the loss of those keepsakes killed her prematurely. My mother had actually been dying since 1955. She suffered her first stroke, with only minor consequences, in 1953. In 1956, she had another stroke, but even after that, she still had a partial recovery and came home from the hospital. My mother had a very hardy constitution, but she was no longer able to live on her own, so I convinced her to leave L.A. and move in with us in New York. She had been with us several months when she suffered the third fatal blow from which she never recovered. She was hospitalized in Rye for a year and a half. We couldn't keep her at home, since she needed constant care. In those final months, she was unable to speak or move, though she was lucid and understood everything. She was literally a prisoner in her own body. What must have been going through her mind? That, to be frank, is the hell I inhabit on nights I cannot sleep. An efficient businesswoman, eh? A woman without a heart. In Max Brod's melodramatic book about Kafka, I learned that Kafka, too, was unable to speak at the end of his life due to tuberculosis in his throat. Unlike my mother, however, at least he was able to write as long as he could still hold a pen. So you see, there is some hint of symmetry. I wouldn't call it justice, the meaning of which escapes us, of course. I end with the wish that the facts I have shared with you here will burden your conscience enough to ensure that you will be more cautious in your fabrications next time. I cannot write either respectfully or cordially, let alone yours, so you will have to make do with my signature. Joachim M. New York, May 18th, 1987. Dear Mr. Kennedy, consider this note of mine an addendum to the letter I wrote you 12 years ago, to which I never received a reply. As you may recall, I wrote you about the promise Zalman Schocken made to my mother, which was what finally convinced her to entrust her letters to him, namely that he would donate the manuscripts of Kafka's letters to the National Library in Jerusalem. I have just learned from an article in the paper that my mother's letters were auctioned off at Sotheby's in New York for $605,000, reportedly a record-breaking sum, at least so far as manuscripts go. Over a half million, sir. And they gave my mother $8,000. The deal of the century, don't you think? The buyer was neither a library nor an archive. Where would a place like that come up with that kind of money? It was a private party, whose identity was not revealed. The letters have vanished into a private safe, maybe forever. So, that's the end of the matter. They cheated my mother even in death. What a disgrace. She was absolutely right to want to destroy Kafka's letters. Pity she didn't succeed. Regards, Joachim M.
1935, Geneva. The thin masts of sailboats bristle at the end of the street. As the wind blows from the northeast, strong and steady, every line in the anchorage whistles at a different pitch. The boy stops and listens. Sharp white-crested ripples play across the lake, the sky pale, clear, cool. For 4 years, he has been walking home from school the same way, twice a day. In the other direction, he usually runs. He knows the lake in every weather and time of year, at twilight, in the dark. Darkness falls early in winter. The scraping of wood, the hollow lapping of water against the boat's flanks. His mother and aunt have already begun to sort and give away the things they won't be taking with them. The only thing going in the suitcases is clothing. Books, porcelain, paintings, silver rugs and furniture will make the trip later, once they have settled in. Moving from Berlin had been worse. Even his mother had cried then. But his father had insisted, and now he was dragging them away yet again, away from Europe, where the ground was disappearing underneath the Jews' feet. The street leads along the park, the surface of the water hidden behind the trees. He turns the last corner. Their apartment building has the air of a seaside hotel, with its long decorative balconies, colorful shutters, and niches galore. They have already moved 3 times since leaving Berlin. When they first came to Geneva, his father rented a villa. Then his mother was badly missing Berlin, so they returned there for a while. That turned out to be a mistake. The second time they fled, they lost a lot of money, having to pay a special tax to be let out. Next, they rented a smaller apartment in the center, and it was only when his grandmother came to stay with them that his father found the place on Rue de Montchoisy, by the park, near the lake. The rooms weren't large, but at least they offered some privacy. And now, since his grandmother had passed away, there were 7 of them at home. Father, mother, Joachim and Lily, Aunt Else, Cousin Hannah, and Bertha the maid. They didn't have a governess or a cook anymore. On the 3rd floor, outside the door to their apartment, Joachim catches the aroma of roasted meat. All of a sudden, he realizes how hungry he is. He presses the doorbell button. There are voices from inside, but no one comes to open the door. After the 2nd ring, he hears the sound of sharp footsteps, followed by silence. The door slowly opens.
"Oh, come on," he says, throwing himself on his sister. "Stop that and don't shout. Mom has company from Berlin."
"Who?"
"Some lady named Margarete. We're supposed to call her aunt, but I don't remember meeting her. She won't stop talking. They shut themselves in there."
Sunlight streams through the glass panes of the drawing room door, casting dapples of blue, red, and green on the white wall. The parquet floor creaks, the colors dancing before his eyes.
"Home already?"
His mother has on a dark blue dress with a low-waist pleated skirt and a string of red coral beads wrapped twice around her neck. Her dark blonde hair, graying at the temples, cropped just below the ear, blazes ginger red in the sun. A petite brunette woman in a light-colored dress rises from the sofa behind her, outstretched hand, holding a lighted cigarette.
"Why, you must be Joachim!"
He has to walk over and say hello. The top of the woman's head barely reaches his chin, but she tugs him down toward her and plants a kiss on both his cheeks, leaving behind a trace of red lipstick.
"You're all grown up. Do you still remember me?"
She ruffles his hair with her hand.
We used to be practically neighbors. I lived on Sidanstraße, a little way down from Hilda Hildebrand's famous actress. Professor Einstein lived near me, too. He's in America now. Everyone is running away. Maybe you'll be a Hollywood actor. Such a handsome boy. He takes after Ferrier.
The visitor gives a loud laugh, takes a drag on her cigarette, exhales a cloud of smoke. She smells of sweet perfume and the herbal liqueur his mother likes to offer guests before lunch. Two cut glass tumblers containing the remains of an electric green liquid stand next to the ashtray on the table, one on either side, like an honor guard. "I'll go see what's happening this lunch," his mother says. "The children have to get back to school. As long as you aren't too hungry, we'll wait for Robert to eat. I'll have the table set in the dining room."
"Oh, I'm never hungry. Look at me. I couldn't gain weight if I tried."
How could he not remember her? She always talked too loudly and had never missed a party that his mother threw in Berlin. That nervous, high-pitched laugh of hers reminded him of honking horns. He was shy around her and didn't like her, especially the way she embarrassed his mother in front of other people. Apparently, his mother didn't mind, though, since she kept inviting her over. No dinner on Victoria Luisa Platz was complete without her presence. The red beads were also a gift from her.
"Excuse me for a moment," his mother says. "Play something on the piano, or have a look at the latest fashions. I have a whole stack of magazines there."
"Don't you worry about me. I won't be bored. I'm too busy counting my losses."
Again that obnoxious laugh. Grete takes a drag of her cigarette and walks to the window.
"Pity you don't have a view of the lake."
The only person home when Joachim and Lily return from school that afternoon is Berthe, the gloomy-faced servant girl. She warms up some milk for the children and puts a plate of buttered bread out on the table, then rushes straight back to the stove. Usually no one cooks in the afternoons at their place. Lunch is the main meal, and for supper they make do with a piece of bread with lard or a bowl of soup from lunch. But today, apparently, there is a feast being prepared. They can smell their aunt's pulled strudel from the oven, and Berthe is angrily banging pots around.
"What am I supposed to do when they leave me all alone like this?"
she grumbles. "I'm not some fancy chef from Berlin."
"You're doing just fine," says Lily, trying to calm her down. "Do you know where my mom is?"
"The ladies went for a walk in the park," Berthe hoots. "In this wind! And you, young master, had better be careful, too. Your cheeks are blooming red. This springtime sun is fierce."
"Did they tell you how long that lady was staying?" Lily asks.
"They just told me to make up a bed in your grandmama's old room. I haven't got round to it yet, seeing as I've been shut up in the kitchen all day. But those are some right big bags she's got. Looks to be, she's moving."
"I hope not in with us,"
Joachim blurts. A door slams and the sound of voices carries from the hallway.
"They're back," Berthe breathes a sigh of relief. "Now maybe the madame will help me out with supper."
The boy quickly finishes his milk and carries his empty plate, along with the mug, to the sink. As he walks out the front door, he almost collides with his mother.
"Where do you think you're going? Can I go out for a while? Don't you have homework? It isn't due until Monday."
Tobacco smoke wafts from the half-open door to the drawing room. With the sun shining from the west now, the colorful panes of glass have dimmed. "Supper is at 7.
"Can I eat at the Weinbergers?"
"No."
"Please, Mom, they invited me."
"No, we have guests."
"All right, Mom."
He slips past her and hurries out the door. It's 5 o'clock. He can still catch the evening service at the synagogue. The only part of Shabbat that Joachim's family still keeps is lighting the candles, which his mother does before supper. Apart from that, Friday evenings in their home are the same as any other. But at his best friend Leo Weinberger's, the family has a silver cup, over which his father, wearing a yarmulke, recites, Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam borei pri hagafen, before passing it around. Then he says the blessing of the hand-washing and the sweet challah bread, and only after that do the vine-bagas tuck into their meal. And how cheerfully they eat, even though they really have no reason to be happy. Mr. Weinberger had told Joachim the story of how they escaped the first time, during the war, fleeing the Eastern Front and the pogroms to Berlin. Mrs. Weinberger was pregnant with Leo at the time. There, they survived both the post-war flu epidemic and the inflation crisis. But no sooner had Mr. Weinberger, a teacher by profession, found a better job and begun to bring home some money, than Hitler came to power. They didn't want to give up everything all over again, so they missed the right moment and got to Switzerland just as the laws against refugees, whose numbers were constantly growing, began to appear. Among other things, they weren't allowed to work. Mr. Weinberger taught Hebrew clandestinely, his pupils paying him in cash, one class at a time, and Leo's mom worked as a cleaning lady. Leo shared a room with his two younger sisters in the small dark apartment near the synagogue where the five of them lived. Yet the mood there on Friday nights was always more joyful than it was in Joachim's household. The only time it was cheerful in the splendidly furnished dining room on Rue de Montchoisy was when their father wasn't home. On those rare occasions when their father was away on a trip or eating dinner out, their mother and Aunt Else spoke at a higher volume, reminiscing about their childhood in the town of Neustadt in Oberschlesien and moving to Berlin. They told stories about their crazy uncles and aunts, there were plenty of them in the family, and going out to dance in Berlin, all the different dresses they had and the suitors who tried to woo them. They would laugh, though it wasn't clear about what, and after dinner they would play games, hide-and-seek, duck-duck-goose, red-light-green-light, or Aunt Else would sit down at the piano, which she didn't dare do in front of their father, and play Viennese waltzes and old Jewish songs and also a few Hungarian tunes, which she'd learned when she was still living with her husband in Budapest. They rolled back the rug, and their mother taught Lily and Hannah to dance. They tried to convince Joachim, too, but he refused. He didn't have to skip around like a madman to feel happy. Grete isn't the only company they have today. Seated at the table is another old friend from Berlin, Hermann Eisner. Even the children are allowed to call him by his first name, as Uncle Eisner hardly seems appropriate in his case. Hermann is a psychiatrist, originally from Prague. It was he who scoffed the most on September 15, 1930, when their father announced to the guests one night, during a dinner party on Victoria Luisa Platz, that the next day he and Felice and the children were leaving for Switzerland.
"Forget Switzerland, Robert! Just come stay with me in Grünewald, it's much closer!"
The room exploded with laughter. Grünewald was where Hermann had his private sanatorium for the mentally ill. They dined on stuffed quail and drank champagne for their farewell supper that evening. Hermann Eisner believed in German humanism and democracy, and was convinced that Hitler and his gang of convicted criminals, as he referred to them, were not to be taken seriously. No one could force dictatorship on the nation that had given birth to Goethe and Heine. And if anyone wanted to try, they would have to be of higher caliber than an uneducated psychopath with an inferiority complex. Having deftly assembled a diagnosis of the Führer, Hermann predicted that soon he, too, would end up in Grünewald. They all laughed over their quail. As late as January 1933, Hermann wrote an essay for a newspaper in Berlin about the invincibility of German democracy. Less than 2 months later, on March 6th, just before midnight, he was pounding on their door in Geneva. He had come to apologize. This evening they dine on chicken soup with dumplings, then stuffed veal, with a light burgundy to accompany it. They are celebrating the arrival of Grete, who just the day before, was that even possible, had still been in Berlin. They reminisce about their favorite cafes, bakers and tailors, milliners, pastry chefs, waiters, even benches in the park. The city's fabric of faces and places, creating a feeling of safety and home. Much of it even Joachim remembers. For example, the zoo, where he used to go with his nanny, and the aquarium, where he'd stood gaping at the...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?